And we have on the line right now Paul Helfrich, PhD, and we're talking about Jane Roberts and Seth phenomena. We had a bit of a technical problem, but hopefully we have that at least somewhat mastered. Welcome back, Paul.
Thanks, Nico.
Okay, so we were talking about, you had brought up the three main things I think you discerned from Jane Roberts.
Our world, ourselves, and how we can all get along.
That's what you personally got out of it as you were looking through it, or that's you did intensive study to come up with this? Or?
I've been researching this for 20 years on and off, so it is my way of introducing new people who might be interested or open-minded enough to at least entertain some of the ideas in it, how I would introduce the Seth material and conscious creation to those with our world, ourselves, how we can all get along.
Okay. Perhaps this is leading us into the idea that you create your own reality. Maybe you want to kind of introduce that subject.
Yeah, before we dive into that, I want to elaborate a little bit on ourselves, some of the ideas about what we are.
Okay.
I mentioned the idea of multi-dimensional psyche. Psyche is the same thing classically, conventionally meant by the soul, a non-physical aspect that lives outside of physical reality and transcends death, so to speak. So it's our primary identity. And even though as human beings we live, we grow through developmental stages and pass away, at some part of that identity continues eternally. That's a perennial idea. Now, the way that Seth teaches this idea is interesting. It also is made up of three parts. He calls it the conscious mind. The conscious mind is made up of three main aspects that are nested holistically together. They're not separate, the same way that the colors in a rainbow are not really separate. From a distance, you can see where red turns into orange, turning into yellow and green. But when you get up closer and you look at that edge between two colors, it's seamless. So the conscious mind is made up of three seamless aspects that he calls the outer ego. And the term ego comes from psychology, and it's our sense of waking identity, the center of gravity of who we are in our waking lives. The second part of that is the subconscious, and the third part is what he calls the inner ego, which is synonymous with spirit or soul. So these three aspects seamlessly work together in a multidimensional sense. We talked also earlier about the perennial philosophy and the idea that there is a non-physical source reality that is not discernible by scientific instruments and scientific method yet, but has been discerned by 3,000 years documented in the perennial philosophies of the world. So this conscious mind, the outer ego, the subconscious, and the inner ego, a way to understand that is through an analogy that I use of an iceberg. You picture an iceberg. It has a tip that's protruding into the air, and that represents the outer ego. This analogy, then, the surface level where the air meets the water is represented by the subconscious. The subconscious is a vast, vast mediating layer of the conscious mind that deals with heart rate, body temperature, cell growth, cell death, growing your hair, digesting your food, metabolic processes. It's not all just the brain stem and the reptilian brain, but this is a bridge area to what's beneath the surface, then the submerged part of the iceberg, which is the inner ego or the soul. And in this analogy, the submerged part of the iceberg is literally infinite. It extends infinitely. And yet we get a sense of this outer ego as a discrete thing in terms of our body and our lifetime. In terms of a physical life, the iceberg analogy represents what we could call a Sethian view of the psyche, which is multidimensional. So it exists in space and time, but it seamlessly, simultaneously exists outside space and time. That's a perennial idea. It's not new at all.
So, yeah, the idea of the soul existing outside space and time is, yeah, gone back as far as I guess we have written records.
Yeah, and just the thought, too, at this point, that we've talked a lot about the perennial wisdom and a 3,000-year-old written tradition, and it goes back tens of thousands of years. What's interesting to me about the Seth material and the Seth phenomenon is that it occurred in the United States in Elmira, New York, which is near the northern Pennsylvania border. It's a 5-hour or so drive from Philadelphia and even closer to New York City. It occurred in the United States, and it occurred 39 years ago, so it's less than 40 years old. What we have then is a body of perennial wisdom that's been translated only once into English, which is my native language and most of our listeners' native language. So I'm bringing up the element of discerning what's true, what's not true, what's valuable, what's not valuable, that there's very low distortion. And I should make another point at the beginning when dealing with the Seth material. He states unequivocally, and I believe it's in session 47, for those of you who might want to check, that he is not to be considered an infallible source. And that means the information in Jane's 30-plus books is not to be considered a complete grand unified theory or theory of everything. It is incomplete. And what's startling to me is when I realize that is what's called a postmodern or a reaction to the modern world idea that no one person, not even in this postmodern view, a Christ or a Buddha, if they live today, could be considered an infallible or a complete source of knowledge of any kind. And when it comes to wisdom, which is based more on intuitive understanding, yes, they are undoubtedly wise individuals. But to be privy to these three characteristics of the divine principle of omniscience, omnipresence, and omnipotence, Seth does not pretend to be omniscient, omnipotent, or omnipresent. I think when we deal with religious or spiritual, metaphysical, New Age ideas, it's important to keep that in mind. So Seth is not to be considered an infallible or complete source.
Which seems to make a lot of sense in that, I guess, just by definition of being a discrete personality can have, you know, can have absolute knowledge of anything.
Exactly, and that, to me, is at least evidential that it's an authentic phenomenon. It's in a very, what I consider a very small percentage of anomalous or paranormal phenomena that is authentic. We can't explain it, and yet it manifests the Seth phenomenon in such a virtuosic and deep, rich manner that it can't be ignored and it can't be fully explained. So it's authentic in that postmodern sense that it's not infallible. A fallible source, and it's incomplete. And I think all of the great thinkers of today admit that. They come out and say that. And not that I consider myself a great thinker by any means, but anything I say, I readily admit I don't know it all, and I never will know.
Yeah, I guess, you know, from a certain perspective, if you know it all, then, you know, what's the point in existing anymore? Which I guess actually gets us off into another area. But, having read the Seth material myself, some of it, it strikes me as, coming across with the same, in the general ballpark of ideas that you see in religion, in Christianity. The thing that's the closest to, for me anyway, in my experience, is probably Buddhism and also, strangely enough, the ideas of Robert Anton Wilson, who comes very close to kind of a lot of Seth's ideas in a lot of ways, though his body of work is not quite as focused. But of all those bodies of work, I'd say that the Seth, at least in my humble opinion, seems to seems to have more information that's been more useful to me, easier to understand. Perhaps it's because it was written in English so recently. I think it's a little more accessible than a lot of other perennial wisdom. Would you say that's true?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, we all played a game, Whisper Down the Lane, or Telephone, as it's called in different parts of the country, as kids. That's a game where someone makes a statement and whispers it to the person to their left, and that person then whispers that to their person. You go around a circle of 10 or 15 people, and by the time the last person pronounces it, it's been distorted beyond recognition. This is a beautiful analogy for what happens with perennial wisdom, that it goes into the molds of language, which is filtered through the belief systems, cultural values of the time, and it's calcified instantly as soon as it's put into language. And so there's this Sufi concept, and that's the mystical branch of Islam, where they use the word baraka, and it has different definitions actually in different contexts, but one of them is potency, and that a perennial teacher and teaching has a baraka, has a potency, and it's temporary, and they recognize that. And part of this discernment issue that we bring up is to keep on the radar screen when that baraka or potency is waning and being distorted, and that the needs of the times that this information is geared to is no longer working. And we look at human history, and it's an evolution of culture, evolution of belief systems, an evolution of technology, of economies, and cultural values like that. So the Seth material, again, is less than 40 years old. It's been translated into other languages, and there have been 7.5 million books sold to date since 1968 or 70 when the first book started coming out. So Jane did sell millions of books. They're in German, Dutch, French, Italian, and so on and so forth. So that process of losing its baraka has already started. Interesting thing to be able to witness that process through our lifetime, that and any other body of work that goes together. And I also wanted to comment on what you said about what you have found. I agree with that the closest thing the Seth material and conscious creation comes to that I have found is Buddhism. And in particular, there's different flavors of Buddhism, and so that can get distorted and bounced around a little bit. But to be specific, what I've found is called Dzogchen, and that's spelled D as in dog, Z-O-G-C-H-E-N. Dzogchen means great perfection, which stands for the ineffable source or spirit or God. So anyway, it's not a religion, so to speak. It's a philosophy or science of mind is what Dzogchen Buddhism is. So it's very interesting and a very esoteric branch of Buddhist thought. But it's, again, a perennial philosophy, and it is very close to Seth.
Yeah, I think many people misinterpret Buddhism as a religion, which it is not. It's a philosophy, a wisdom, a way of looking at existence. I think in some ways Buddhism is kind of closer to, it is a philosophy. You know,
it's a philosophy of mind, the philosophy of who we are. And as you start to go beyond the five physical senses and engage your deep intuitions or sixth sense, or what Seth called the inner senses, and there's a term for this in all the perennial traditions, you start to get a sense of that.
Yeah, and I've noticed the similarities between the Seth material and many Buddhist teachings are quite striking. Not in any particular sense, but just on a from a general philosophical perspective.
Absolutely.
The next area here. In reading this material, it, I guess, unlike some other philosophical things I've read, actually has precise practices. I mean, there are yogic practices and many other practices in, I guess, in Eastern thought. I'm not clear myself on the historical or current connections between Buddhism and yoga and things of that nature, but it occurred to me that the Seth material kind of incorporates that within it also, not only physical practices, but mental practices as well, which I think is something that it's kind of been missing from other things, because it's a really effective way of getting something out of your explorations into epistemology or the meaning of self.
Just to comment on that, Vico, within the perennial tradition, we look at body, mind, and spirit as the three reducible parts that we're looking at. And earlier, we were talking about the eye of flesh, the eye of mind, the eye of contemplation. Any authentic yoga is not just doing stretching and breathing exercises. That only deals with one of those three. That's the body. But the mind-body connection is very much a part of that. And the transcendent part or transcendental part is an integral aspect of any authentic yoga. So body, mind, and spirit. And this comes back to this bridging science and spirit idea, that through an authentic yoga or practice that incorporates all three of these areas, body, mind, and spirit, that we will get deeper answers, we will get closer to this grand unified theory or theory of everything. And in the Seth material, it's interesting. I've been an educator my whole life, and of course we study what's called pedagogy or methods of teaching. And it's interesting to look at the Seth material from a teacher's point of view. And of course he had Jane and Rob as his two primary students for a number of years, and a small handful of friends who became aware that this was happening sort of privately. And then as the book started to get published and Jane began her ESP class and her writing class, 5-6 years into it, it got wider and more well known. But there are exercises scattered throughout the material, and the closest thing to a curriculum occurs in the third Seth book called The Unknown Reality. And as far as the Seth books go, the first one is called Seth Speaks, the second one is The Nature of Personal Reality, and the third one of 18 is called The Unknown Reality. In The Unknown Reality, there are 17 practice elements. He called them practice elements. They deal mostly with the multidimensional psyche, or an aspect, an idea that he called probable selves and probabilities, which does tie back into quantum physics and probabilities, probable states. But when you get into a multidimensional personality, it also has probable selves. And so these exercises deal with probabilities, probable selves, starting to open alternate ways of perceiving those, and then it gets into dreaming and the dream state. And I would say that the core of what we could loosely call a Sethian yoga deals with dream work. And I mentioned this the last time we spoke, that dreams are something we all do every night. Many of us don't remember them or aren't tuned into them at all. But becoming aware of the dreaming self, which ties back into the subconscious layer of that iceberg analogy, that mediating layer between the outer and inner selves or egos, becoming aware of the subconscious is something that's very, very important in the Seth practice and the exercises that he gives. And when you look at the work of Freud and into the expansion of that work by Carl Jung, dream analysis is at the core of the Jungian practice. So it's an interesting parallel that Seth focused on dreaming self, the subconscious self, becoming more aware of dreams and using that as the basis of his, he never called it yoga, of course, I'm just using that as an organizing principle. Again, it means to join or union of body, mind, and spirit. Now, I look at it and other perennial thinkers view it. So it's there, it's there in the material. And actually, I also want to mention, I mentioned the New Worldview website on newworldview.com. In the library, if you click on the library link on the left of any page, there's articles there in the library that have been authored. And one is a compilation that I did of all the exercises that I have found to date. And there's dozens of them, and they cover a whole wide range. So The idea is really to mix and match and put together things that work for you for what you're dealing with, whether it's relationships, whether it's a health issue, whether it's abundance, career, and so on and so forth, that it's not prescriptive in a literal black and white sense, as maybe some of the perennial traditions are, at least to start. I think most of the perennial traditions, as I'm beginning to learn more and more about them, the practices are strict to begin with, but as you start to make the breakthroughs and begin to glean this eye of contemplation and develop this eye, this transcendental, irrational mode of perception, that all breaks down and informs and colors the waking life in a wonderful way. Now, of course, it can go into pathology and disease and even where there's an unstable personality that cannot function, but we're not talking about that. We're talking about people who are stable and can function, and they may be your UPS delivery man, they may be your butcher or baker, your car repairman, or a radio announcer, a wide receiver on a football team. They don't talk about it. They don't share it because it's something that is difficult to talk about to people who don't understand it. So they pretty much keep that to themselves. And that's why in these perennial traditions, these have been kept very secret, because they get distorted and misused, not misused, but misunderstood. And people think that they're learning things and that they're making a breakthrough, perhaps, in this area of all the eye of contemplation, when in fact they're not there yet, and so on and so forth. So it's an interesting and wide open.
Yeah, there's a lot going on there. Yeah, you've touched upon a lot of things. I have found that people tend to... And probably with the Seth material and with other things as well. Yeah, people keep them secret. People don't talk about them because you encounter... I've spoken about it to a fairly select number of people, and if... I can only imagine the ridicule or disbelief you'd encounter in the maybe just someone that you knew casually, because even people that I trust implicitly, you still tend to get a lot of resistance and skepticism. But I mean, it's skepticism is healthy. I mean, that's only natural. But in general, although I think that's probably changing now, people are becoming a little bit more open to new ideas, and but certainly historically, practices have been kept. The guarded secret. It's kind of a cliche. The guarded the wizard or the master keeping his special secrets in his box or in a special book.
Right.
And I think even the stories about that are basically alluding to the same thing, the yogic practices or the practices in the Seth material, which what I find interesting about this is you talked about the compilation of all the exercises that you put that you said you put together.
Yeah,
I actually found that a couple of years ago, and it's quite a toolkit of things that you can use. At least that's an analogy I like to use. That you can kind of pick and choose what you want to use, what's appropriate for you at the time, and it can be very effective in improving any area of your life that is that you're not happy with.
Absolutely, and a bit of advice to anyone out there who follows up and does some practices or whatever, and over a period of time starts to have certain experiences with these things, it's important that you find someone that you can trust, that you can talk to bounce your experiences off of their experience to get a sense of what's happening. There's nothing worse than thinking you're losing your mind or you're going crazy. And in fact, it's a very natural process that you're opening to deeper parts of your consciousness that have been hidden or masked from yourself. And it's a natural and healthy process that happens. And I wanted to also comment on one thing you said, that basically what leads people to this kind of information is having some kind of paranormal experience, and it freaks them out. It's scary because they don't understand it. Another thing that can happen too is a relationship, marriage, or whatever can end. That's very traumatic. Or a death of a loved one, a parent, a sibling, a child. These are the life experiences that are sort of hardwired into this reality that we hide from in our culture. We're taught to fear death. We don't talk about death. And yet death is all around us all the time. And when it touches closely to us, we start to ask questions about who am I, why am I here, what am I doing, what happens when I die, so on and so forth. And that leads you to look for answers, and you end up in these perennial areas. And the Seth material is not, again, meant for 100% of the population to solve all of the world's problems. It's meant for whomever is attracted to it, just as the Buddhist, the Sufi, the Kabbalic, the Gnostic Christian, etc. traditions are. People are drawn to the frameworks that they're comfortable with, and practitioners and people that have experience with these ideas. And as the perennial saying goes, all paths lead to God. Seth says all paths lead to the inner self. All paths in our experience lead to a deeper understanding of who and what we really are. And of course, death seems so final in physical terms when, in my view and in my experience, it's simply the closing of one door and the opening of another door.
And that's a good place to pause here. We'll be back in just a moment and wrap up our show. We'll have about 15 or so minutes left. You're listening to 93.7 San Francisco Liberation Radio. This is Vico and the Vico Show, and we're speaking with Paul Helfrich, PhD, and we're talking about the Seth phenomena, practices, perennial wisdom, and self-exploration. And we'll be back in just a moment. You're listening to 93.7 San Francisco Liberation Radio, your local community, non-corporate radio, right here in the Castro. And this is Vico here with the Vico Show. And we've got about 15 minutes left in our interview with Paul Helfrich, PhD. And where had we just left off? We were speaking of the self and reality. And maybe we want to get into, before our time is out here, the idea of reincarnation. And most of the people in the world believe in it. Seth has a particular point of view on it that is not exactly the same of what we traditionally think of in the West. Maybe you could just, Paul, lay out what perspective you come from on that.
Yeah, this is interesting, and there's a couple of levels to the information that Seth has offered there, so I'll just be introductory, but I'll harken back to what I said about the three basic things of our world, ourselves, and how we can all get along. If we're going to look at reincarnation from the Sethian point of view, we need to take a brief sidebar into our world. And the way he defines the world, he defines it as a multidimensional universe, or we can call it a multiverse or even an omniverse, which means it's not just one thing. It's not an objective black and white thing that's out there, that there's many, many dimensions and aspects to it. And our ability to perceive, we only perceive a small amount through our physical senses. Anyway, we don't perceive x-rays, ultraviolet, so on and so forth. Can't hear sounds below 20 vibrations a second or higher than 20, 25,000 vibrations a second, yet those sounds are all around us, radio frequency. So the world is multidimensional too. And Seth uses the concept of framework. And they're just orienting generalizations to get us ballpark. The framework one, loosely, is physical reality. Framework two is what we would call this potential state in quantum mechanics, what David Bohm called the implicate cave comes to mind. So this idea of different realms of experience are covered in the perennial philosophy, body, mind, and spirit, body, mind, soul, and spirit. There's different layers and realms or whatnot. So Seth uses the idea of framework one and framework two. Now the idea here is that the inner self or soul, this multidimensional source self, manifests simultaneous lifetimes. And this is a, I can't say revolutionary concept, but it has definitely been distorted in the Buddhist Hindu tradition.
So simultaneous lives?
Simultaneous multiple lifetimes. So that the belief system of karma is closely associated with reincarnation as a moral cause and effect. If you're bad in a previous lifetime, then you're punished for being bad, and you're born as a lesser or lower form of human or even animal. And in this belief system, and this is the religious belief system, which Seth contradicts, if you're good, then you're born in a higher caste, the Brahmin caste, thinking of that in Hindu society versus the untouchable. And that's simply nonsense in the Sethian view, that these all happen simultaneously, so there is no moral cause and effect in between these lifetimes. Yet they are simultaneous. They're occurring in what he calls simultaneous time. And we don't have time to go into that too deep. But again, if we talk about our world, what makes it multidimensional or a multiverse is that there are different time dimensions. Very simply, past, present, and future really all exist simultaneously. And if we have these multiple selves, say one self is in 30,000 BC, one self is in 1000 BC, 500 AD, etc., scattered through linear time from this multidimensional perspective of the inner ego or the submerged part of the iceberg, within that context, those selves are all simultaneous. There's actually an example, a playful fictional example in Jane's Oversoul 7 books, where this idea of simultaneous time and multiple personalities existing simultaneously. There's four characters in the first book called The Education of Oversoul 7, and they're in different time periods. And it's a playful romp on these ideas from a science fiction point of view that explains that a little bit. But to summarize then, the idea that reincarnation is linear is wrong, according to Seth, is a distortion. The idea is that these are all happening simultaneously, which then leads us to speculate and wonder from the psychological point of view, from this multidimensional psyche, that it must consist of various psychological veils or barriers or boundaries that this inner ego is learning a proficiency in creating to maintain the apparent separation of these different lifetimes. And it gets very tricky. It gets irrational, in a sense, when the rational mind tries to get around it. And that's why Seth talks about using the inner senses, and in particular, the conceptual inner sense, to discern these ideas, because the rational mind will not accept them, to put it frankly. Mm-hmm. But the transcendental mind, the eye of contemplation, using what he calls the conceptual sense, what the Buddhists call wisdom awareness, is the key by which we each, in our own personal direct experience, our own contemplation, our own meditation with these concepts, can come to grips and actually experience them firsthand.
How do we use the conceptual sense? How would we know if we were using it?
I'm not going to answer that directly, because that gets into the area of, you're asking me, just by analogy, what does honey taste like? I can describe to you its atomic structure, its color, its smell, but unless you've tasted honey, I'm not going to do a very good job in words describing it. And that's a good example of this eye of contemplation and what they call direct experience. When you have a direct experience of this conceptual sense and you then share that with me through the eye of mind, so to speak, and talk about it, and I can compare it to my experiences and say, Oh, yeah, you've tasted honey. That is exactly right. But your version of honey is going to be unique to you and your perception. My version of honey, or the conceptual sense in this case, is going to be unique to me. But yet, through practice, discernment, we come to mutual agreement that, yeah, honey is sweet. It's not bitter. It's not sour. It's not salty. It's not acidic. And so then we come to some understanding that, in fact, we are using this intuition to discern something that is true.
So the conceptual sense would be, maybe a sense of being able to put together multiple concepts? To be able to visualize think about maybe a very huge, complex thing in one bite, as it were.
Yeah, exactly. It's an innate knowing. I can describe a dream that I had many years ago when I was in graduate school studying music. I had a dream about Igor Stravinsky, a famous composer of the 20th century, one of my favorites. In that dream, I had this conceptual understanding of what it was like to play music in the Stravinsky style, to compose music. And when I woke up from that dream, I had a lingering sense of what it was like to actually be Stravinsky. And in fact, the person that I was at that time paled in comparison. My musical ability, my compositional ability, my orchestrational ability at that time paled in comparison. It was really depressing, but it was also quite beautiful to get this conceptual understanding of Stravinsky and his music. So that, to me, is one example of using the conceptual.
Okay, yeah, I understand that. Maybe before we wrap up here, we want to get into the idea that the self is the kind of the center of reality.
You had asked me the question earlier that I deferred answering about you create your reality. And this is a catchword. You create your own reality is a sort of buzzword that's been glued on to the Seth material. And in my view, is not completely understood and is easy to distort and easy to criticize. Mm-hmm. Let me attempt to explain that. The idea, and it's a New Age idea. There are other channeled sources that have picked up on this now in the last 35 years, and You Create Reality is coming out of the woodwork from various perennial sources around us, and I think it can be easily misunderstood. The way that some people misunderstand this is that, and let's bring to mind this iceberg analogy of this multidimensional self, this seamless transition of these different parts, conscious, subconscious, and deep consciousness, all work together to create physical matter and the physical universe as we know it. But that is such a complex process that much of that action has to be veiled from the outer ego, that tip of the iceberg. We can't be involved in monitoring heart rate, growth of all the cells, digestion, and everything, and have this conversation or build a house or drive a car. The outer ego would not be able to do it, flooded by all that. That's why the subconscious, this mediating layer, exists to handle all of this. All this to say that we do create our own reality, but Seth uses the term co-creation. And in fact, the term, it should be conscious co-creation rather than conscious creation. I think that's clearer because these different aspects of what we are in the great web or great chain of being, when you look at it holistically, that there is no separation within consciousness in a sense. It creates its own reality. So what I'm saying is that the distortion, as I see it, is defining you create your reality as a thought process where by thought alone or visualization by the rational mind that you create wealth and health and functional relationships. This is just not the case. The outer ego, that tip of the iceberg, is intimately involved and can use thought processes and rational processes to help and do that and co-create. But the subconscious layer, this inner ego layer, and these gestalts, these holistically nested aspects, really go to the infinity of the divine itself. So all of that is involved in consciously creating. So we're learning to become conscious of the subconscious, of the inner ego, and I believe the Buddhas and historical Christ and Mohammeds and so forth had the ability to consciously tap into that inner ego layer of consciousness and become a conscious creator in that sense. But realistically, we are creating everything in our lives, but it's a cooperative venture between other parts of ourselves and then everybody else in the collective, and then all of consciousness on the planet and the solar system, galaxy, so on and so forth. It's all interconnected.
So what we have here is a situation where people are using their spiritual power and their subconscious and their normal ego, their normal consciousness, to create everything that happens around them. And what makes it seem like that's not happening or seem confusing is that people, at least in this culture that I'm aware of, in general, seem to not be aware of what their subconscious or their spiritual self is doing.
Exactly, and that offers a role model that embodies the blended balance of body, mind, and spirit that he calls dream art science. And that reflects the ideal of using those deeper levels, becoming awakened or conscious of those deep parts of self to create the life that you want, a fulfilling life for yourself. A lot of people misinterpret and run into trouble when they think they're going to consciously create winning the lottery or consciously create a girlfriend or a boyfriend and so on and so forth. And then when it doesn't happen because of their visualizations, they think, well, you know, this doesn't work, this isn't right. And I would just say, right, because you don't understand it. It is rocket science.
Yeah.
Rocket science of the soul.
On that note, I think that's where we'll end. We're just about at the hour here. You're listening to 93.7 San Francisco Liberation Radio, and we've been speaking with Paul Helfrick, Ph.D., and we're talking about the power of the self.
Jane Roberts, the Seth material, channeling, and a lot of other very amazing topics. Paul, it's been a fascinating conversation. I hope that we can do it again sometime. Thanks a lot for being on the Vico Show.
You're listening to 93.7 San Francisco Liberation Radio, your local community broadcaster right here in San Francisco.